Wow, how can I follow up on two great research-based presentations here? I think it's so valuable that we have more data that adds to our understanding, for instance, of the value of expressive writing. We have so much of that being done today in much less structured formats like blogs and whatnot, that I think that additional data is just so useful and informative, even though it's a small study. And then, you know, what Ben just presented about a CBT intervention, motivational approach, interview with primary care physicians, we take for granted, I think, so often that, sure, mental health professionals are, quote, the experts in providing treatment and care, but the reality of the world, of course, is that most people who have a mental disorder never seek out care, and most people who are prescribed a psychiatric medication, it's done through their primary care physician. It's not done through a psychiatrist. So to enable primary care physicians a more active role and something that they can do, I think that data is fantastic. I'm just happy to hear it. Again, my disclosures, Psych Central, that's the website I run, have been running since 1995, and that's how I make my living. I have a short amount of time, which is fine, because what I'm talking about I don't think is news, or it's definitely not research-based, and I am not a traditional researcher in any sense of the word. When I was asked to give this presentation, I really had to think for a moment about what it means to think about online mass prevention of mental disorders. Even the concept and the idea of preventing a mental disorder is a bit foreign to my thinking, so I had to do some research on it. And of course, I started with thinking about, you know, how does medicine talk about prevention of diseases? You can think of immunizations, flu shots. You can think about therapeutic lifestyle changes for heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. You can talk about specific exercises and techniques, like lowering your blood pressure. Again, for heart disease, stroke, kidney failure, which I think, I guess, has the greatest parallel to some of the interventions that we're talking about, direct interventions like CBT and whatnot. And then you also have things like cancer screening, pap smears, mammograms, colonoscopies, again, to try and catch something before it turns into a full-blown something else that would require treatment. So I hear about these wonderful interventions like Mood Gym, which have been around for a very long time, and I wonder, you know, would that intervention ever qualify as a mass prevention tool? Could we ever get a significant portion of the population, for instance, to go and use the Mood Gym? And I have to scratch my head. I think it's one of those areas that I don't know that we have all the answers yet. So I wanted to focus on more passive interventions that reach more people, but probably don't do as well a job of actual prevention. So I'm going to talk about it in a way of prevention in terms of the more you know about yourself and your own mental health concerns, and working on just your self-growth, perhaps, the better you'll be. I kind of wanted to emphasize that many mental health conditions do not have empirically proven behavior-based preventive strategies. If you look at the literature, virtually all of it is youth-based, which is fantastic and great. If you can start with people when they're young, they're teenagers, and you give them the coping skills and the mental health skills to live a healthy and positive life early on, boom, hopefully they won't need adult mental health treatment later on. And also that early screenings, peer support, and education can help. So I focus again on the psychoeducational materials. You can't talk about self-help, psychoeducational materials without recognizing that this is an industry that's been around forever. The self-help books have been in your bookstore for 20, 30, 40 years. It's a $9 to $11 billion industry in the U.S. It's not some tiny little thing that just started yesterday. And because of that, information provides patients with valuable understandings about the nature of mental health concerns. A lot of stigma comes from just having the wrong facts about mental illness, having preconceptions based upon a Hollywood movie or a book or family upbringing, something that was told to you many years ago. The thinking that mental illness is voluntary. It's something that a person works themselves into. So I think these kinds of things can increase mental health literacy, but I also recognize that, of course, there are a lot of biases that exist in the marketplace, even amongst advocacy organizations in mental health. In the U.S., we're experiencing a lot of disclosures about how the pharmaceutical industry, for instance, has really biased certain research and influence that, and has even influenced organizations like the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and their description of how mental illness works. And it's a biological brain disorder. It's not something that you need psychological interventions for. It's something that you need medication for. I mentioned this in the other presentations, so I won't go into it here. So obviously, you're familiar with all these different things that we've talked about previously, and that you've heard previous presentations on about. And I just wanted to emphasize that there is a lot of interesting things being done still with just, you know, printed static information. Now we have the Kindle coming out, and everything's being translated to the Kindle. We have social networks. Growing out the informal conversations that you have in groups. You wouldn't believe how much mental health information is passed around in a self-help support group, for instance, and how much information is given about treatments and things to try, and not just, you know, the recognized empirical treatments, but also a lot of home remedies or other things to think about, like exercise and keeping moving. Something that you probably Helen didn't talk too much about was the fact that they've also developed something called Blue Pages, which was a focus of multiple research studies demonstrating some efficacy, just having people read depression information. Because although it's difficult to get people to do a full-blown CBT intervention sometimes, a full-blown 10-module program like Mood Gym, it's a lot easier to get people to sort of read some pages, to read up on information. You can even give them a quiz afterwards. And these are examples of static, information-driven websites. Psychological Self-Help is a free online self-help book published in 1996 by a retired psychologist. And it has 1,000 pages of self-help strategies. It probably could use an editor, but 1,000 pages is a lot. It's in Kindle format. It's ridiculously large in Kindle format. I know because I've downloaded it. I just want to mention my site. I can't help but mention it. Only because we reach so many people. We reach 1 million people a month. And we have 100,000 members in our support community and our support groups, we do try and talk about not just mental disorders as a disease or a condition that needs to be treated, but also healthy living, psychological strategies for improving your life, your relationships. We try and focus as much as possible as we can, as our audience allows us to, on some of the positive things. So one of the, for instance, one of the new features that we just came out with a month ago is a new blog on family mental health and how to have discussions about healthy living within a family, relationships, communication within the family amongst children and parents. A service that we produced about 2 years ago, something called Sanity Score. Again, it's a way to try and engage people in their mental health, because if we called it a mental health screening measure, imagine how many people would take it. No one would. That's the problem, is that there has to be a little bit of suggestion that this is something that could actually provide you with actionable information. That it's not, we're not just here to screen for disorders and whatnot. But that's what it is. It's a generalized screening measure. And as you see, we have 21 subscales here that we give the person, and we go through the list here, and you see the little, you can't really see on that screen very well, but there's a little exclamation point next to the depression subscale, because that subscale actually it rose to significance enough that, hey, this is something that you may want to check out further. This is something you may want to talk to a professional about. Again, I talked about metanoia because we're short on time. I'm not going to mention it again here in this conversation, only to say that, again, a simple static page can help be a preventative measure in stopping something as horrible as suicide. And you see something like Psychology Today in one of their blogs. The blogger just published Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia Part 1, where he's walking people through specific targeted exercises on the website to help them through it. And because it's a blog, people can actually engage in a conversation with John Klein, who wrote this entry, who works at the Sleep Disorder Center of Connecticut, and get feedback on, like, oh, you know, I tried this and it didn't really work for me or whatnot. And again, you've heard about Mood Gym, so I'm not going to mention that. But just to sort of summarize and to say that information is very cheap to provide. It's very heavily consumed if you position it correctly. And when I think mass prevention, when I think population-wide prevention, you have to actually design interventions. You have to design the information to be something that people actually want to read and come back and engage with you more. I think we could design all the programs in the world to and show their efficacy in research, but if no one uses them, then what's the point? And that's the challenge that the research has shown to date in terms of some of the programs, is that people will try them. They are willing to give them a try. But it's been very challenging to get them to stick with them. And I think there's obviously lots of opportunity for improvement. There's just a trial that I think Helen mentioned. Deprexis in Germany is another CBT intervention that researchers just published in a study about. But only 15% of their participants that started at the beginning of the trial reached the first assessment point, which was week 9, 9 modules in, 15%. That's 85% dropout. So we have to do better. We have to find ways to get people interested in it and stick with them, because obviously the long-term effects will be more robust if we can get people to finish the program. So thank you very much.
Super advocacy groups and their influence. And one experience I've had with this is editing some materials for the National Institute of Health. They have like a website and edited one for eating disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And I left in text that discussed family factors. And what ended up was a writing campaign was begun by groups of parents saying, this is outrageous, this material shouldn't be in here. And eventually, HHS got involved and actually found someone to rewrite it to remove any references to families. And I'm kind of wondering, families have become very powerful, and I think NAMI's become very powerful, sort of like the idea like there's no behavioral issue here, it's all chemicals. And you see that sort of having sort of an effect on shaping the information that's available and sort of...
In the U.S., NAMI is very powerful as an advocacy organization, but it receives 56% of its funding through pharmaceutical organizations. So, but they've, to put it in historical context, they have always taken the exact same line. It's not like they've suddenly changed and became this organization that said, schizophrenia is a brain disease, period. Like, that's it. Depression is a brain disease. Bipolar disorder is a brain disease. And that has always been their line. But they have a lot of influence. They have a lot of pull when it comes to talking to other organizations and saying, look, because you don't, they're just influential as a consumer organization as well. But online, I mean, things can snowball very quickly, too. If you anger the wrong group of people.
There's another bit of history. There's a saying that hard cases make bad law. Where NAMI started that line actually was in the era of the so-called schizophrenogenic mother, in the sort of pre-dopamine receptor hypersensitivity era. And they were very angry that parents were inappropriately being blamed for making their children schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where that... But they overreacted. I mean,
absolutely.
So now you can't say anything about family environment or stress or anything else. And pharma saw that as an opportunity and was glad to have them. But I think it raises another question, though, because the Internet era is very different from the era when, the professionals had and wrote the books and disseminated the information and controlled it much more. This is more democratic, but there can be a tyranny of democracy as well. There can be a tyranny from the bottom up. And I think it is a real challenge. And just the kind of thing you talked about, I think is a very bad thing. I think it's bad when one interest group can censor material that responsible professionals think ought to be out there. And I wonder what we can do about that, because it's an opportunity but a danger in the Internet.
Well, the Internet runs on crowds and masses, and so I found the best way to fight against a subgroup like that, which can cause a lot of anger and upset and publicity for their point of view, is to get another crowd to offset that crowd, and which is easy enough to do. Surprisingly, you just have to motivate them to say, "Well, what are you talking about? Of course, family is a factor. Everything's a factor. I mean, psychological personality is a factor. You can't just sit there and completely discount family factors. That's ridiculous." So, it's more challenging. It depends on the specific issue or whatnot.
Surely there are enough wars going on in the United States and around the world to really add another one, trying to fight the Cartesian battle. Is it mind or is it body? I think there is one common purpose, and I'm a psychopharmacologist who also believes and does CBT, so I feel that there has been some integration. The big problem that both pharma faces and any type of online CBT program faces is quite simply attrition or adherence. I have the same problem. 85% of anything that I prescribe isn't taken after the second prescription. So what? The question is, what can we do, and what kind of interventions, even bizarre interventions, can we think about to increase that adherence? And I think we have to start looking at other modules and other paradigms for increasing loyalty to treatments, whether they be psychological or pharmaceutical, and we're beginning to explore giving people points that they can spend for completion of programs. So what if they get a toaster if they complete 15 sessions of CBT?
I mean, really, you do have to start thinking, I think, a little bit more creatively, whether it's drug adherence or CBT adherence, or because no treatment is effective if people don't complete it. That's what it comes down to. I think the statistic is that most people never come back for the second, therapy session. So there's a book, called One Session Psychotherapy, because that might be the only intervention time you have with people. I don't think it hurts us to think outside of the box and how to engage people more. I think we also have some ideas of how to keep people engaged, though. I think there is some research out there about how to do that. For instance, in research, I don't know how this translates as well into clinical practice, but when you do telephone follow-ups for interventions, you get more engagement, whether it doesn't have to be the doctor or therapist calling. It can be a nurse practitioner or even an office assistant that says, oh, have you filled your prescription? Just, again, that personal follow-up, checking in on people, that's all, a lot of time that's all people need or want.
Mm-hmm. But what you're facing is those are costly interventions.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Text
them.
Just send
them
a text.
There you
go.
Or Twitter.
You should be sending out food for your children for when they come home. This isn't it's 5:30, you should begin dinner. It's 7 p.m. You should take bill number 9. Fire off text to people.
I agree. Thank you.
We're actually...
Yeah, we have to go break for lunch also.
Now we are experiencing some research into the area you are mentioning. We know that people love to collect miles. It doesn't matter if it's certain miles, air miles. But it's income independent, so it's not only interacting to people with mild money.
There you go. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.